Buddha, he didn't directly take on the warrior society and everything. He took on castes all equally and saying that they're nonsense. But he was not what I would call, he wasn't interested in social activism at all. He was very aloof from that. What he said and what he was trying to do is remove the cause of injustice, which is greed, hatred, and delusion. Not band-aid patch, you know, setting up new rules and enforcing them, and that's not getting rid of the cause, that's hiding it, you know, putting it underground. So we have our civil, we have our police. Every country has police and military to make people, because if you think about it, all the police disappeared in America, what would happen? People would do what they have inside them. They go out and start robbing and stealing and looting, and you wouldn't be afraid to do those things. So the Buddha wanted to remove the cause of those things, not, he left it up to society to police it, because that's not what he was interested in. One example struck me. It's a very simple example, but a good example, and that is the Buddha's walking down the road and he sees some children. And there's a small pond that's drying up because it's coming into the hot season. And the water's only that deep and the fish have nowhere to go and the kids are hitting them with sticks. And the Buddha doesn't chastise the kids. He just looks at them and says something like, all creatures want to be happy, all fear death. And walked on. Armies, at one point, two armies were at a river fighting over water because it was not enough water. It was a drought. And the two armies heard, he didn't go to visit them. They heard the Buddha was in the vicinity, and each one king from each army went to visit him so they'd have good luck getting rid of their opponents. So like getting the blessing, that's what they're thinking. And they went to visit, they went to the Buddha and they arrived around the same time. Of course, it's truce because they're near the Buddha. And the Buddha simply asked them one question. He says, what is more valuable, water or blood? And they took their armies away. You can't imagine the Buddha protesting or marching or, no. Definitely not what he would do. To him, with his long vision, he's seeing thousands and thousands of years of this, right? The same thing, with no cure. So if you come up with if you have a disease, and they say, I'll remove the symptoms, but you'll still have the disease, and there's another doctor who says, I can cure it. I'm not interested in the symptoms. I'll cure it. That's the difference. So there are socially engaged Buddhists, and Thich Nhat Hanh is one I think of, who's socially engaged Buddhism, marching, and the Vietnamese are fairly well known for that. Tibetans. This might be new to them, I don't know, but they're into politics. They can't be pulled out of politics. So that kind of thing the Buddha was not interested in. And it is the fact that the world can't be saved. That you cannot get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion in every person. You can't do it. It's not possible. So this is why I say, I teach the Dhamma for those who have little dust in their eyes. And his hesitancy, when he became enlightened, I'm not going to teach. He said, first of all, he decided I won't teach. He didn't want to socially, well, the word social, he wasn't social. He didn't want to socially reform the world. He wanted to cure, he wanted to give the cure to individuals so they could cure themselves. And this is kind of what we were talking about before when I talked about govern. You must govern. To govern, you must govern yourself. So that's the way he looked at it. If you can govern yourself, which means you get rid of your own greed, hatred, and delusion, you can govern other people. First you govern yourself and you have that ability. Let's say stream winner. You become a stream winner. Doubts are gone. You really understand the Dhamma and there's no backsliding. Then you can govern yourself. Then you govern other people. So then you govern your family. You can govern your family. You can then govern the village. You can govern the city. You can govern the province or state. You can govern the country. If you can't govern yourself, you can't govern anything. Not well. You make mistakes all the time. It's we all have wrong view. So people view the world in a wrong way, and that's the problem. So he was interested in teaching people how to govern themselves. Then go out and govern other people. And we always do it backwards. We're not able to govern ourselves, but we know, well, you know, those who can't do, teach. It's that kind of thing. We're going to talk about the seven factors of enlightenment today. And you've got your book, so you can look it up in there. Mindfulness is the first one. Some of these, of course, we've talked about many times in different ways. Sati. In Pali, that's sati. Investigation of phenomena. Dhammavijaya. We talk about that a lot. Energy. Virya. Rapture. Piti. Calm, pasadi. Concentration, we've talked a lot about, samadhi. Equanimity, upekha. Sati, the first one, we've talked a lot about, because that's exactly what the four satipatthana are, the four foundations of mindfulness. Gaya nupassana, mindfulness of body. Vedana nupassana, mindfulness of feelings. Jitta nupassana, mindfulness of mind. And Dhamma nupassana, mindfulness of particulars in mind, mind objects. There's a Satipatthana Sutta, of course, is where the Buddha says there is this one way for the purification of beings. And he talks about mindfulness of the four Satipatthana. Sati being mindful, Patthana means a base of, or the basis of, or the underlying pinnings of mindfulness. Gaya Nupassana, I talk about fairly often, and that is investigation of body or mindfulness of body. Mindfulness of body is being aware of taking apart the body, being aware of meditation on death, meditation on dead bodies, meditation on bones, meditation on how we, you know, skin. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth, and skin. And we talked about why the Buddha chose in particular those five and what the meaning of those five are, because those are the things that we like. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth, and skin. They have the common factor of being all dead. And they have the common factor of being all on the outside of us, and the common factor is that is what we lust after. That is also what we see as me and mine and I am, and also what we identify other people as, even though it's a minor part of the body, because it literally is skin deep. Vedananupassana is sensation of body, the feeling of body as it's seated, the feeling of body as it moves, the feeling of the wind against body, the feeling of heat, of cold, mosquito bites, sensation of body. Cittanupassana, the mind's general state. It's a general state of mind. Like, it's the one where we say, how are you feeling? In other words, we're asking about somebody's mental state. We really don't want to know their medical background. Although you might get that sometimes. How are you feeling? I'm happy. Yeah, I'm feeling good. Oh, just so-so. You know, we're talking about a general mind state. Is it sorrowful? Is it depressed? Is it anxious? Is it happy? Is it calm? Is it etc.? Sati of that means being aware of our general mind states. Just as we're aware of the sensation of body and aware of body itself. Dhammanupassana is a particular state of mind within mind. And usually what the Buddha is talking about, most often mentioned, is the hindrances. We're aware of the hindrances we have in mind. So, kamachanda, for instance, the hindrance of sensual pleasures. A mind that is, when you look at a mind, you say, generally, it's happy, it's a happy mind. I'm in a good mood, I'm happy. But then you look into it and it wants something. Never, ever, ever does the mind stop wanting. It's like thirsty, hungry. Except when you're in samadhi. When you are practicing meditation and you're in samadhi, it stops. It doesn't want anything. Outside of that, no matter how happy or how miserable you are, when you look in the mind, it's wanting something. It's always, always wanting something. So when you say to someone, someone says, I'm happy. I'm perfectly happy. You know, why would I need Buddhism? I'm perfectly happy with my body, my mind. I'm happy with my life. But if you had like a genie in a bottle or the good fairy come along and say, okay, I grant you 3 wishes. Who would not take those 3 wishes? And they're always something they want. I wish I were younger. I wish I had a giant bag of gold. I wish I had power over the universe. Everybody wants something. Well, I like my body, but you know, I change my nose. And they do if you have the money. We change the color of our hair. We change the way, you know, makeup. We do all, you know, to make us look. We're never happy with our bodies. Nobody's happy with their bodies. And the anorexic models that parade up and down, they're miserable with their bodies. So there's that, kamachanda is that gnawing, it can be, but it can be also a mad thirst where you say, I have to have this. You know, it gets out of hand. So that's a particular of mind that we should pay attention to. Vyapada, ill will, dislike, annoyance, hatred. That is always somewhere. It may not be to the fore. Now, when your Dhammanupassana is looking at what is the particulars of mind, what will appear as a particular of mind will be the biggest one. It'll be the one that's strongest at that point. So if somebody's sitting there and they look into the mind at the particulars, then they might come across dosa or hatred. And that goes from slight annoyance to rage. If we look into our minds and we find those things, because we've got those things, we just ignore them. It's almost like we feed and nurse them until they're ready to come out and, you know, do a little damage and then kind of disappear again. Anxiety and worry. Who doesn't have that? These are things that everybody has. I've got them. I've been chasing them around for years. I've still got them. I don't... Sloth and torpor. I love that phrase. Sloth and torpor. It doesn't mean three-toed and two-toed sloth. That means like lazy. If you've got sloths in your mind, then you've got problem. So we look in and we see, I'm going to put it off. I don't want to do it. You know, that's what that trick is. Doubt, not sure. I'm not sure. And people come here and they say, well, I like Buddhism, but I don't believe in... Everybody likes the black and white, right? I like Buddhism, but I don't believe in rebirth. So, I said to the person, you know, in 2 minutes, you are going to believe in rebirth. Or less than 2 minutes. 2 minutes, you'll believe. All that, just listen. 2 minutes, they did. From I don't believe to, oh, I didn't understand. So this happens all the time. Doubt. And we gnaw on it like a bone. You know, you get something you doubt and you'll just start chewing on it and gnawing on it and won't let go. It's the mind having a lot of fun. Because no progress is made. Come to a wall and you stop. Oh, geez. I don't know about this. It's not a wall, it's a pillar that you're standing with your nose in front of, and all you have to do is go around it. But that's the nature of doubt, is to stop you and make you waste time, waste energy, waste brain cells on something that you could push it aside and shelve it, or walk around it. And a lot of the doubts are cardboard. There's nothing real. All I have to do is knock it down, because it's simply not understanding something that makes us doubt. So Dhamma Nupassana is a tool that we should use a lot. We should wonder, we should look, and we should be mindful of what's going on. And again, this covers the khandhas. This covers the five khandhas. This is body and mind. This is the Dhamma Nupassana, Chitta Nupassana, Vedana Nupassana, Gaya Nupassana. Covers body and mind. Investigation, mindfulness of body and mind. We live with it 24 hours a day. We're always with the body. We have to haul the thing around. And we're never really there. So the mindfulness is being there and being aware and saying, okay, what's it up to? It is our universe. In Buddhism, that is our universe. I have to worry about whether there's life on Mars or all the other stuff. It's entertaining, but it does not cure. The Buddha's interested in a cure. How do you cure all those things? Those are, and if we look at those things as unpleasant, body is pleasant only when we look at it through a deluded lens. We don't look at we ignore and delude ourselves about the ugly part of body, and we look at, develop, and search for how the beautification of it, even the divinity of it. Well, anybody who's a doctor knows how divine body is. It is not intelligent design. It is not not a bad design, but it is faulty, far from perfect. It is made to be broken, fall apart. It is not ours. It is subject to stress. and it's totally, every particle in part is impermanent. What is there not to love? Now, if we all went on dates like that, we would never get married or we'd never go on a date. Jeez, this guy or girl, you know, they're full of stress, they're totally impermanent, they don't belong to me, and they're going to fall apart. I don't think I'll invest in that. Houses last longer. They're not such a good investment now either. But. So the Buddha says, to balance this gayanupassana, you know, investigation of bodies, to balance this deluded idea of body. And it's just this, state it right out there, it's a cause of racism. See a bunch, the color of dead flesh on the outside of the body makes us designate a race of people. Oh, they're black, they're red, they're white, they're yellow. And actually, I've never met a yellow person. Supposedly, that's Asians, right? Unless they're jaundiced, they're not really yellow. And Native Americans are not red. Anyway. But it's the cause, misunderstanding body, and just seeing the dead part of body, which is just dead skin cells, which are all over this table. Kids don't dust in here very well, by the way. This might be a lot of the temple boys we're sitting on. A lot of this is just ourselves, because we're flaking off all the time, like a snake. Otherwise, as they say, would evaporate. So those four things, those four aspects of mindfulness. Mindfulness is one thing. It's just one thing. Being mindful. What the Buddha offers us as a tool, as a target. And why those four things? Because wisdom arises from those. Wisdom about Panjupadana Khanda. The five grasping khandas. Not just five khandas, grasping khandas. Whatever the Buddha gives us, it is for development. That's where the word pawana comes from. In Thailand, you practice pawana. They never say vipassana. And they never say, I'm going to go practice samadhi. You go to a meditation temple, forest temple, for pawana. Pawana means development. It includes samadhi and panya. Development. Many people come to the temple. This is seven factors of enlightenment. It's a half hour only on the first one. This is going to be 7 weeks. You realize that? Many people come to the temple and they say, I want to learn meditation. So I say, what for? It sounds cool, meditation. It sounds cool. But without vinaya, without discipline, without virtue, without morality, which is, you've got to be a good person to practice meditation. Well, I want to relax. I'm like anxious and hyper and worrying. Oh, yeah. Maybe you do things that are anxiety producing. I always wonder, you know, meditation is becoming very popular in jails. It seems to be a very religious place, jails. Then you say, well, wisdom, what about wisdom? Because the Buddha's whole aim is to develop those things together. You can't develop them apart. If you do get meditation down and eventually be able to practice it, you just become a rock, piece of wood, some brainless thing. Because meditation in and of itself does not arise no wisdom in it. It's not what it's for. So mindfulness is not just for meditation. If you are not mindful, you're not going to be virtuous, you're not going to be ethical, you're not going to be moral. If you don't have mindfulness, of course you can't practice meditation. And if you don't have mindfulness, just as we were talking about the four satipatthana, how could you develop any wisdom? So the Buddha says, yeah, be mindful. Just be mindful. That's it, your job. Then he gives you targets. Then he gives you subjects that will sharpen your wisdom, that will give you an insight into body and mind. That's all you got. You just got body and mind. Even for those of us who have actually paid the mortgage on the house and own it, it's still not yours. And we divide land up and we say we own it. It's not really ours. But what we do have that we're totally responsible for is body and mind. And that is our source of happiness and unhappiness. Mindfulness makes you moral, makes you ethical. Mindfulness is good for concentration, necessary. Center of concentration and meditation. Mindfulness is totally necessary to produce wisdom. If you're not mindful, you're thinking. Oh man, that's it. So many people I meet, I've studied Buddhism for 10 years, 20 years. Come on, I can name everything in Pali and English and maybe another language, Urdu. That they can't meditate out of a paper bag. You write books, lots of books, write books. No calmness, no insight. If you had a particularly smart Amazonian gray parrot, they could do a lot of that. Parrots are not that bright. Mindfulness, the objects that Buddha gave us to be mindful of, and the insight that comes from it, even in a person who can't talk, even in a person who can't write, even someone illiterate, in low IQ, that person understands. Many teachers I went to in Thailand were totally illiterate. They couldn't read and write. They couldn't even speak Thai. They spoke a dialect of Lao. And they couldn't teach. Smile a lot. Try to tell some corny joke. But they were really, really understood. They really were much freer than us. And very happy. Happy people. Just happy sitting in the forest. And you think, that inspires. You see that. How do they generate that? They're generating happiness. It's like a nuclear fission. And you get around them and you're happy. You feel happy. You feel they're just oozing it. How do they do that? Mosquitoes, poison snakes, scorpions, tigers, elephants, and they're sitting in a bamboo hut that leaks when it rains. Happy as can be. And here we are, you know, 2 or 3 cars, big house, bank account, and we're like, ah. We're not oozing happiness, we're oozing stress to each other. 2 stressful businessmen meet, zapping each other with stress rays. Then you put the monk in the middle of them. Doesn't even have to be a monk. There are people, not monks in Thailand, too. And Burma's the same. Cambodia, Laos, where there are monks and people living in temples, not monks, who are just happy. I've met a lot of people dressed in white that lived in temples all their lives, and they're absolutely happy. They own nothing. Well, I can't be a monk because, hey, I got to do this and this other thing for monks. I'm making merit that way. That's hard to find. Mindfulness is the trick. You have to be mindful from day one, second one. Dhamma Vijaya, we've talked about that. I've talked about it and talked about it. Dhamma Vijaya. seeing things as seeing things in perspective, seeing things in perspective, proper perspective, to look at things in an investigative way, gives you the act of Dhamma Vijaya, the act of investigation of phenomena, is a proper perspective. It's a healthy perspective. You look at something and it isn't immediate faith and acceptance. It is, what is this? It's asking that question. It's analytical. Mix that. Of course, I never, Dhamma Vijaya is connected to Yoniso Manasikara, which I've talked about a million times. And I always say that's like wise attention, asking the right questions. Perspective is a view. Dhamma Vijaya is a view. Investigating, have a mind that wants to know is part of a view. So how we view things, how we view our lives, how we view, and in this case, how we view our body and mind. If we view our body and mind in a deluded way, we're never going to investigate it because it brings up things we don't want to see, we don't want to hear. We have belief or faith that it's not true. Vipajavada. Vipajavada was actually it means analytical teaching. Theravada, teaching of the elders. Vipajavada. Analytical. Vipaja is analytical teaching. Actually an early name, it's actually an early name for Theravada, for this sect of Buddhism. Because it was analytical. It was the third council, Buddhist council, that this sect of Buddhism that has survived till now, Vipajavada, later becoming Theravada. That Vipajavada is the one that went to Sri Lanka. King Asoka's son, Melinda, took Buddhism to Sri Lanka. And it was this analytical sect that went. Before that, there were other sects of Buddhism. Mostly, they argued about Vinaya, monks' rules. Not too much about doctrine. And the ones that had a weird doctrine or a different doctrine, they went north. And then you get the Mahayana line. They had emphasis was very different. It's the same thing, Dhamma Vijaya, the same thing we've talked about before. It is an analytical perspective, position, view of phenomena, and when we talk about phenomena, Dhamma Vijaya, in this sense, is talking about body and mind again. It's our body and mind. Look at it. One of the ways that's analytical is you always keep in mind the three characteristics of existence when you look at anything. It is subject to stress. May not be stressful now, may not be stressful at this point. It is subject. It will be stressed. It will cause stress. It is impermanent. It is absolutely impermanent. You don't have to have faith in it. You don't have to just look at it. It's impermanent. And it is not me. It is not mine. It is not myself. I do not own this thing. If we take that criteria in whatever we do, that in itself reduces a lot of stress. I'm going to get a big tropical fish aquarium. Disaster for older people. Fun for younger people. All the fish are going to die. Some of them like a week after you buy them. Swim, 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 and they start going in a spiral, and you say, what's wrong? And you dump in the blue stuff into the tank, and they all drop dead. And if you're really good and you're very careful and you keep a balanced aquarium, they'll live a while, but we know they're going to die. Dogs and cats, pets of all kinds. We know they're going to die. It's things that we cling to. It's only the amount of clinging and craving we have to something that causes it. That is the stressometer. So if it's someone we love and is very close and we're very attached to, that is going to cause the most dukkha, the most suffering. If it's a cheap goldfish that you won by popping balloons at the fair, you'll just flush it down the toilet and Goldie will be gone. You can't do that to mom and dad and grandpa and grandma. The amount, the stress is equal to the amount of attachment. When you look at everything, you prepare, when your mind is prepared in the three characteristics, it's not that you won't be sad. It's not going to be a sort of an Irish wake where you tap dance on the coffin or something like that. I don't mean Irish in particular. We don't have wakes like that. Although some relatives may be glad when we die. Most people are not. At least they don't show it. They show that they're unhappy. But if we're prepared, you'll be sad, but it'll be wise sad. It's a difference between stupid sadness and wise sadness. Even when the Buddha died, when he went his final passing, his khandhas fell apart, he died. There were monks wailing and crying and gnashing their teeth and beating their chest, which apparently was the fashion in India. Couldn't pull their hair because they didn't have any. And the monks who were arahants said, what is going on with you people? The Buddha said before his death, when Ananda went off and cried, he said, call him over here. He says, haven't I told you again and again and again, everything is impermanent. This is all stressful and this is not me. What are you weeping for? So it's not you become a Buddhist and you're going to be a stoic at the funeral and just say, you know, like some kind of robot. Because even Ananda, who lived with the Buddha up until he died, was totally devastated. That's not what it is. What Ananda had forgotten, what Ananda had lost sight of, was the three characteristics. So Dhammavijaya, investigate, take apart, and it's always accompanied by, if we go in reverse, yoniso manasikara, wise questioning, wise attention. Ask the right questions. Look at the right things. The right questions are what? The Buddha. What did the Buddha tell us to look at? If we can't figure it out, basically he gave us a kid's coloring book. But if we get in the way, we don't see it very often. We sometimes lose sight. Simple. It's quite simple. Wise attention, ask the right questions. What are the right questions? The questions have to do with the Four Noble Truths. This is stress. This is the cause. This is its ceasing. And this is how to do it. Frame it. Frame the questions within that frame. Can't go wrong. You can't go wrong. It's not complicated. As I said, so many of the people I met who had really attained something great were not complicated people. That was perhaps their gift. They saw the tree. They didn't see a forest. Sampajanya, clear comprehension. Dhammavijaya, yoniso manasikara, sati, with sampajanya. Sampajanya, clearly comprehending. Mind is clear, it's focused. Sati is being aware of something. You must aim sati at something. Then you must have sampajanya accompanying so it doesn't sort of drift off into fantasy and other subjects, other objects. We've talked about that a lot. Those four things together. Dhammavijaya, there you go. Sati, Dhammavijaya, those are the first two factors of the seven factors of enlightenment. And they don't just cover, seven factors of enlightenment actually cover everything. As we go through them, they cover everything. So does the Eightfold Path. So do the Four Noble Truths. So do the three characteristics of existence. So does dependent origination. Virya, okay. Samavayama, everybody knows Samavayama. Samavayama. Right effort. People who have been coming here for years are going, oh yeah, here we go, right effort again. Ah, but there are some people who don't know what right effort is. Virya and Samavayama, both of them, right effort. That's what it means, right effort. Four right efforts. Everybody knows the four right efforts. Well, not everybody here, but most of you know the four right efforts. If I were to ask someone to recite them. Virya, what do you think of? Energy. Virya, energy. It's putting forth effort and energy. Well, you might think of yourself running around the yard raking leaves or, you know, lifting logs or... It has nothing to do with physical energy. Virya is mental energy. Mental. You can't say, oh, they've got a lot of virya. You see somebody running around cleaning the house or shoveling dirt or... No, that's not what the Buddha's talking about. He's talking about that same effort that is body. He's talking about here. Mentally. Energetic. Energized. There's a flavor of readiness to it. Virya has that readiness to do. So the four right efforts are... It's good that we hear these things over and over again because we should think about them. First effort, first right effort, to develop good qualities that you already have. If you want to plant a garden and you buy a really nice plant or flower or whatever your tree, and you plant it and then you forget about it. Well, you should see our garden in the summer. Kind of looks like that. Wilted. It'll wilt. It'll die. It's not nourished. It's not developed. It will not come to growth. It will not come to fruit. It will not come to flower. It will not come to seed. Somebody says, wow, I've got this great flower. Look at it. That's great. I just got this. And they think it'll stay that way forever. You can lose good qualities. Like a leaky boat. And you may think, this one bad quality I have, or this one good quality I have, it's fine on its own. Those qualities that we develop that are good qualities need to be protected. They need to be developed. So protection of, care of, and protection of the qualities we have that are good. Generosity, compassion, empathy for others, loving kindness, equanimity. You'd think that one would be the easiest to cultivate because it's just equanimity. That's the most difficult.